Lecture 3, Nietzsche as Master of Suspicion and Immoralist.
Lecture 3 will be on a topic I richly enjoy because I have in a way made suggestive remarks about Nietzsche, but I hope they've also been substantive, at least in this regard. I understand that there's much debate on these contentious positions concerning the rather untruthful origins of truth. By that I mean its origin within the human community. The contention that relativism and so-called perspectivism are not threats, but rather challenges to our creative and interpretive imaginations and powers. Also, I've tried to make the substantive, brief but substantive case, that facts do not occur independent of their interpretations, that facts are implicated in interpretations. In this third lecture, but I'm going to try to do the following. I'm going to try to highlight one of Nietzsche's most systematic arguments, and here we will see Nietzsche again involved in a kind of paradox. He will be trying to show us the immoral origins of morality in the same way that I briefly but less systematically indicated he tried to show us the untruthful origins of truth. In this section, I will be discussing Nietzsche. As a phrase that Paul Ricoeur used about Nietzsche was that he was a master of suspicion. So I would like to contrast at least one aspect of what has been called Nietzsche's style, which I will discuss briefly before I get into the substantive argument. One aspect of Nietzsche's style that Ricoeur's phrase master of suspicion captures brilliantly is that many of Nietzsche's various arrays of considerations are not intended to be demonstrative or to have you necessarily adopt his position. In fact, one sometimes feels in that odd position, talking about Nietzsche, that you may recall from a movie like The Life of Brian, where people think that Brian is the Messiah, and Brian screams out, it's a Monty Python movie, he screams out to the crowd, "Don't do everything that I do. Don't say everything I say." And the crowd goes, "We won't do everything you do. We won't say everything you say." And this is a bizarre feature of that paradox that we discussed in the beginning with Nietzsche. It's part of what I call the Nietzsche effect. So rather than view him in that way, it's nice to look at him as a master of suspicion. Rather than doubt or skepticism, some of what I'm about to present now of Nietzsche, after a brief discussion of his style, is Nietzsche as master of suspicion and immoralist. And what he wants us to do is to, as it were, suspect along with him the origins of our morality. This will not necessarily call upon us to abandon any specific moral position, but rather to look at its origin critically in order to suspect it. And suspicion is not necessarily a bad thing, either concerning theories, governments, or relationships with other human beings. Suspicion can be quite healthy. It, after all, is an attitude extremely appropriate to a truly inquiring mind, you know, as opposed to merely jotting down the familiar canons of knowledge. Suspicion is a quite powerful exercise. So Nietzsche is, in that sense, a master of suspicion. When I get around to that part of Nietzsche, I will be discussing, and I will get around to it briefly after we're talking about his style or styles again for a moment. I want to return to that just for a moment because it's very important. After that brief thing, then I will discuss on the genealogy of morals. That is perhaps Nietzsche's most systematic work. And in this book, On the Genealogy of Morals, he proceeds with a genealogical method, which I will contrast with a properly historical one. And then we will look at some of the fruits of this method. For example, this method, in this case, will be applied to the origins of our morality, both in ancient Greece and through the Christian tradition. And we will look at at those origins of our morality, and as I say, the suspicion that Nietzsche will want to raise in On the Genealogy of Morals is that our general moral fabric has itself a rather immoral origin. This won't be quite as simple as it sounds now. I'll work through that in a moment. But I can't resist a few remarks about Nietzsche's playful style, and here I want to mention some of the new Nietzsche, Nietzsche's return, and some of these dangerous characters that lurk around the university now, deconstructing canons and letting women write about masturbation and having African Americans hold courses in their own culture and these outrageous things like that. So I think we'll talk a bit about Nietzsche's style or styles. There's a famous discussion, and you'd have to know a little bit about German philology and scholarship to really appreciate this. When German scholars do the complete text of someone's work, they don't leave much to chance. They dig through a lot of writing. They get the complete works. So there's a rather famous scrap of Nietzsche's writing that I can't help but discuss briefly that will do two things. Will remind us of a little bit about Nietzsche's tricky style, because without his tricky style or styles and ways of presenting, perhaps this issue about I'm about to talk about wouldn't have come up. And it's also another way to remind us about the undecidability, perhaps. By undecidability, I mean of interpretation, I mean how it is impossible to find a way above the plane of interpreting communities in which to judge interpretation, as it were, a God's eye view on them. I'm denying that we have such a view. Or what philosophers have sometimes called the viewpoint from the standpoint of eternity. Or what I prefer to call the view from nowhere, since there ain't no there, there. There ain't no there, there. And there's no viewpoint like that. Well, among Derrida's, some people appreciate that. Among the fragments of Nietzsche's work, they found a slip of paper, and on it was written the following brilliant, perhaps brilliant aphorism. It might have been Nietzsche's most brilliant aphorism. It says, I have forgotten my umbrella. So the issue arose, should this be included in the complete text of Nietzsche? Is this an aphorism that should be numbered and put in the Will to Power, for example, or left as an unnumbered aphorism? And in general, it raises the issue of how should it be interpreted? Is it part of the complete text of Nietzsche? Well, if the complete text of Nietzsche means in the straightforward sense that some buffoons think everything he wrote, then of course it should. But if a text is this special canonical thing, it captures the truly lasting and enduring legacy of Nietzsche, then one might want an argument why I forgot my umbrella should be included. Right? I mean, you'd expect to have such an argument. Well, this problem wouldn't come up with a normal writer. I mean, otherwise it would be just like, fragment, throw it away, this is a fragment. But because Nietzsche writes in fragments, aphorisms, and various styles, you've got to pause for a moment before throwing away, I have forgotten my umbrella. Now, how would one go about solving this puzzle about whether to interpret the slip, I have forgotten my umbrella, as part of Nietzsche's text or not, part of his complete works? How would one bring his works to completion in that way? Well, a famous argument here is in Spurs, Nietzsche's Style, a book by Derrida, where, believe it or not, he writes a small book on this one fragment. Now, the interesting thing about Derrida's joke is this. By writing a whole book on this fragment, he has surreptitiously, sneakily, included within the text and the overlapping history of interpretations of Nietzsche this otherwise undecidable fragment, which has now become a fragment of his text, which is now part of the history, you see, of the interpreting of the text of Nietzsche. So there's a little joke behind the joke. It's a very clever book in many ways, but I want to get around to what I take to be its point. And it also should support what I made last time as in too contentious a way. Namely, that there are interpretations. It's not that there are no facts, but that interpretations set the range within which facts can be appealed to, as well as truths and canons. In fact, you may have to interpret the whole history of your civilization before you should decide what should be a canonical text. In any case, the issue that Derrida wants to raise there, and I will raise briefly before I get on to Nietzsche and the genealogy, Derrida wants to raise in the spirit of Nietzsche, the question of the undecidability of interpretation. The central point that he makes is this. What is style in writing? We talk about a writer's style. Well, it's a writer, something like this, a writer finding her or his own voice, unique way of, as it were, writing. It's already odd because they must be selecting a voice from among that finite ensemble of possible narrative voices in a culture. Even when, as a brilliant writer might, such as Nietzsche or James Joyce, they extend the bounds of those possibilities. Not narrow them back to Shakespeare, extend the bounds of possibility. So Nietzsche was one of those writers that did extend the bounds of possible writing. Style is a creation, as you see, of this kind of singularity. And Nietzsche's styles, which should be in the plural, actually, because there are many, Nietzsche's styles open the problem of interpretation in a radical way. Because, as Derrida argues, if there is style, there must be more than one. If there's interpretation, there must be more than one. This point is systematic and theoretical. Style is only style to the extent that we can distinguish and differentiate it from another style. Interpretations are interpretations only to the extent that we can distinguish and differentiate them from other interpretations. So the very idea that there might be only one way to write the truth, only one interpretation, one last and final canon, one last book, is a nonsensical idea. Good books don't lead to the end of writing. They produce volumes of writing. Plato's writings didn't end writing. For God's sakes, they write about Plato every year. They write 25 more dissertations. Good books create more writing, more conflict, more canon confusion, not less. So that's a point I want to make to reinforce the very important idea that what we're dealing with here are interpretations. And that it is in the conflict, not the confluence of interpretations, that we can see, as it were, the life of a culture and of a people, whether they are what Nietzsche calls decadent, in other words, on their way out. It's a nice way to gloss what he means by decadent, on their way out. And before I give some of Nietzsche's quasi-positive mythology, life-affirming, as I've been using it, means on your way in and up. Life-denying, decadent, on your way out. Okay, look, that's West Texas gloss, but it'll have to do till we get on to the more positive theoretical work. Okay, now this is a systematic argument, and I don't think that I can finish it within the compass of just this lecture. I may have to return to it. But I wanted to start with that one last note to pin down that point on interpretation. The point being this: there can't be a single one, or there's no interpretation, and there can't be a single style, or there's no style. I mean, if a computer wrote everything, there wouldn't be a concept of style. Computer just, it's all just computerese. No style, just computerese. There's got to be more than one to be style. There's no interpretation if there's just one. There's got to be more than one. So this is a systematic point. Okay, now we're on to, thank God some of you are going to say, we're finally on to one of Nietzsche's texts where he does make a systematic argument recognizable to philosophers. That means he takes a theme. He pursues it through a series of essays. He sticks with it. He stays fairly serious about it because it's a fairly serious subject. What he wants to trace is the origin of our moral values. This is not a discourse in ethics. It is a genealogy of the entire range of Western ethical discourse. So this isn't a utilitarian theory or an Aristotelian theory, communitarian theory, Kantian theory, deontological theory. None of those. It's an exercise in, as it were, going into their genealogy, their origin, in order to see what are the conditions for the possibility of all those theories and evaluations. It's a different project. It's not that all those other projects are worthless or whatever. Nietzsche's after something different. And what will come out of the genealogy of morals, which we're on now, we're beginning to start, what will come out of it won't be a new moral theory, but a suspicion about moral theories. Just a suspicion about them. Okay, now let me tell you what I think that the genealogy of morals, what is its method? And I think for a change with Nietzsche, we can actually discuss method for a moment. Because we have now a precedent for discussing the method of Nietzsche and the genealogy. A very well-known French thinker, Foucault, has raised genealogy to an extremely high methodological level in a series of brilliant studies such as Discipline and Punish, The History of Madness, and in many other studies. So let me try to identify, along with Foucault, some of the elements that are genealogical as a method and oppose them to a more historical approach. One would think a historical approach is what you'd want if you were looking for origins. Well, let me try to separate the two briefly. I'll start by trying to give a brief account of what a genealogy is. A genealogy attempts to uncover the formation of an entire discursive practice. So in that sense, it is not within that discursive practice so much as about it. In other words, it wants to uncover the conditions for the possibility of that discursive practice. Let me try to give an example here without using Nietzsche's right now. One might take the following interest in certain medieval texts, like the Malfucarium, which explains the conditions under which male prelates get to burn women, which they did by the thousands in the medieval period. Well, one might not want to know whether the women really were witches or not. To me, that would be an outrageous kind of question. To me, I lived after that time, see. But I might want to know this. What were the conditions for the possibility of forming a discourse within which people even thought they could have a true-false, good and evil distinction about women being witches and making the male organ fly around the room and decapitating prelates in the dark and mating with animals? Who in the name of the world could have possibly thought they had the conditions for that kind of discourse as one that at the time was viewed as rational? I shouldn't say at the time, since the Malfucarium is a text upon which has been praised in many circles not too long ago as a basis for certain legal texts that we read today in law school. But anyway, it's another little thing you might suspect. The question here is, what are the conditions, not of these sentences, true or false, because in a certain way, this is not a historical question. It's not like one wants to interpret them sympathetically and historically to understand them. One might not want to do that because you see them filled with too much blood and barbarism to stand to do it. This might make you too sick. But you might want to know a deeper question. What are the conditions that form the discourse? And I don't want to make it sound real textual and sort of a deconstructive literary. These are not just discursive practices, right? Witch burning isn't just a bunch of talk and writing. It's burning humans. Foucault was always willing to distinguish between a discursive practice, which was purely discursive, and the practice itself, which would be actually burning women. And I think that's a distinction, as long as you maintain it in a rather commonsensical way, worth maintaining. Sort of like the distinction between chair and electric chair. The distinction. Not all distinctions are bad. I can live with that one. I want to distinguish chair from electric chair. Text about witch burning from witch burning, okay? Well, so one of the things that genealogy will do is to uncover the formation of a certain kind of practice. What it wants to do, too, is to attempt what might be called a reversal of perspective. Now, in the way that Foucault uses it, which I even prefer to Nietzsche's, to be honest, Foucault uses it in the spirit, and here I'm going to quote Whitman. Foucault uses the genealogical method to do this. Foucault, like Whitman, doesn't come to sing songs for accepted victors only, but for slain and despised persons. Nice quote from Whitman. I like that quote. In any case, Foucault's genealogies want to reverse perspective and allow us to see or attempt to see from the standpoint of those upon whom the practice was inflicted what the practice might have looked like, to reverse it, as it were. It's like a gestalt switch. It's not supposed to be a mystical thing. It's a method. It's like when you're writing a history of the working class and all you're reading are bourgeois historians, you might decide, oh, hell, I've read Studs Terkel. I think I'll pick up a book where some actual workers talk. Historian friend of mine, Larry Goodwin, told the story about the first book he wrote on the populist movement. And he realized that all the other books so far, that he read in history on the populist movement in the United States didn't have one damn farmer in any of them. He thought that was odd. He said, I think I'll write a history about farmers that has some farmers in it. What a ridiculous thing to expect, like having a democracy without citizens. In any case, we expect a lot of ridiculous things now. Yeah, genealogy has a reversal of perspective built into it. Now, this distinguishes the genealogical method, this third point, besides reversal. The third point distinguishes it from both Marxist in the orthodox sense, which no one, I guess, is worried about now, history, and from other kinds of history writing, is that we don't look for a singular subject in the manner of great histories. You know, history made by great men, you know, that tradition. On the other hand, we don't look for collective subjects either, namely identifiable and specifiable groups with agendas. Instead, what we look for in a genealogy is for the deeper relations of what is sometimes called macrological power or force to force. Small, very hard to trace relations of forces to one another. And this relational perspective is very important for writing this kind of history. Much easier, in fact, to characterize after reading one than to do so abstractly like I am now. You don't look, in other words, for the subjects of the history, but for how the various conflicts and forces and real antagonisms played themselves out. And in the course of that, in fact, certain subjects will emerge, collective and singular. Anyway, the fourth point, and this one, of course, comes from Nietzsche, and Foucault accepts it too, and it will be made use of in the genealogy, and it will return to an earlier point of mine, is that one must see the truth of such accounts or the accuracy of their interpretations as a kind of choice one has made. In other words, you don't just accidentally write a choice, write a book called The Illiberal, Illiberal Education. You have to make a choice and then pick out the anecdotes you want to make your point. I mean, after all, don't historians do that really anyway? Genealogists want to do it self-consciously, with more reflection, in other words. I mean, I've got to even say this about some histories with which I'm very familiar and friendly. E.P. Thompson's History of the Working Class is not really interested in much that goes on in the drawing rooms, because he's made a choice, has decided on a certain approach. Once he's decided on the interpretation, my earlier point about facts returns. That means it's not the case there are no facts. It's just that the frame in the interpretation is going to decide for you pretty much what they are. You know, it's going to help you decide what counts as one. You know, there aren't any anecdotes in D'Souza's book, Illiberal Education, about the overwhelming success of programs about that relate to the fates and affairs of women and minorities. And I don't take that to be accidental. I think he made a choice. He didn't want any of the good stories in there, but the bad ones. I think that was just the product of a kind of choice. The genealogist, in writing the genealogy of a certain practice, makes a choice. In other words, takes a perspective. And one of the things I like about the method is this, that I like to know there's a perspective there up front so that I don't have to wait for the hidden agenda to slap me in the face later. It's what might be called the problem of interrogating Supreme Court justices. One would like to know in advance so one won't be surprised later what their perspective is. One becomes profoundly dissatisfied if you're told they have no perspective. It's the same dissatisfaction one feels when one hears a white male saying, "I am not a racist." It's a self-refuting remark. One you wouldn't feel compelled to make unless I'm not gay. I'm not a racist. New forms of certain things come back. Oh well, I'm not a racist. Always that. Wouldn't that relax you if you were an African American to hear that? Oh, don't worry about me. Not very relaxing. Okay, all this is to set up genealogy and the process and project of suspicion. Well, in the genealogy of morals, now we're into the argument, and I don't think that I can finish it in one lecture, but we will start Nietzsche's argument in the genealogy of morals. Sorry about that. Nietzsche wants to trace the origin of our values. In other words, what are the values of these Western values? Not going to go into, you know, this isn't an ethical theory. He wants to know, what is the value of our values? Now, the question here, and I'll have to address it much later, is, well, what do you mean by value? And I have said rather vague things like value for life. And I'll have to fill that in later with an account of Nietzsche's own myths and other things, and I will try to do that later. But for now, I'm after purely negative game. In other words, now I just want to shoot my targets. Later, I'll build some clay pigeons of my own. Right now, I'm just shooting targets, okay? So this is the negative part of the argument. Nietzsche wants to trace what is the origin of our values, the value of our values. In evaluation, interpretation, will are everywhere. You know, we value things all over the place and differentially. And there are classic theories about ethical evaluations that surround, no matter how complex some of these get, they surround issues of good and evil. And that's one of the ways that Nietzsche draws the opposition within the West, the opposition between good and evil. I hope not too esoteric, since if you don't have that one down by the time you're about six, horror movies don't make sense. You got to have that sort of a rough cultural idea, you know. He wants to know what lies behind these evaluations. The procedure that he follows in this text is to make use of certain modes, forms, and kinds of historical investigation, and importantly, he wants to look at the texts, the crucial ones that have helped to structure our understanding of whole bodies of discursive practices and the ways in which these evaluations have come to be made. The schema, as it were, of the book is as follows. We're going to look at the general question of the value of our values by looking at our morality. Our morality we're going to look at in its true and original home in religion. You know, we're not going to take for granted that morality grew out of the Enlightenment and a set of procedural legal rules, but that morality grew out of the fertile, embodied, substantial, rich soil of religions. By religions, I mean important things people believed about their purposes, whether they'd live, die, and so on, and where they'd go afterwards. You know, the kind of, you know, ticked off questions that Job asked God, you know. Why'd you mess with me? And what's going to happen if I die? And you and the devil have really, you know, mucked with me, and I want to know why. As you know, God's answer to Job is kind of rough. It's, shut up. I'm big. I'm mean. Get off of here. I can do worse. If you've seen the movie Hellraiser, you know it's true, too, right? These are horrible movies. Don't go see all these movies. Hellraiser is a terrible movie. Specifically, Nietzsche wants to go to a religion that he takes to be crucially important in the moral development of the West, and I think that so does William Buckley. He and Nietzsche agree. Christianity. So Christianity will be one of our focuses. I want to say about Nietzsche's suspicion of Christianity that I don't buy the entire suspicion. I have a distinction I want to make, and it's a little bit critical of Nietzsche. For me, I like to make political distinctions. I prefer them to theoretical ones. For me, I want to distinguish two kinds of Christianity, and I'm not talking about Catholic and Protestant, although James Joyce thought those were interesting to distinguish. Does anyone remember what Joyce said when he ceased being a Catholic and some British reporter asked him, well, have you lost your faith, sir? What's the problem here? Now that you've stopped being a Catholic, are you going to become a Protestant? To which Joyce responded, I've lost my faith, not my reason. Which, for you Catholics out there, I think that's a great remark. I've lost my faith, not my reason. In any case, I like to distinguish in Christianity between two kinds of religion, one represented by Billy Graham and the other by Martin Luther King, a name I suppose I can use a proper name properly. Yeah. It's not slanderous to either one. But I like to distinguish between people who lead their people out of bondage and then people who are busy playing golf with the Pharaoh. It's a rough distinction between religious people, but some forms of religion have more of an interest in golf games with the Pharaoh. Others seem to have more interest in leading their people out of bondage. That's a distinction Nietzsche doesn't pay much attention to. I would like to. But for now, let's just get polemical, broad, and look at the Christianity in Nietzsche's way as a form of life, and look at it in relation to its to first. For Nietzsche, there's Greek life, and it represents a certain thing to him. Nietzsche was trained as a classicist, and in spite of his acute intellect, I have to argue that he always remained a little too in love with the Greeks, a little bit. Nietzsche was trained that way. He always remained a little bit too enamored of them, although he was one of the people that helped to demystify many aspects of their life. He wants to look at the schema of values of the Greeks and how they became Christian values, which Nietzsche argues later become decadent and life-threatening and lead to a third kind of evaluation, which is really, as it were, the dead end that he sees civilization headed towards. And this is that threat I mentioned earlier of nihilism, that threat I mentioned earlier, the threat of nihilism, not as a personal belief, but as something that could be the fate of a culture. Now, I ought to tell you that there are some contemporary theorists that believe this is all already over, that our culture, and this is why I've given the title of the course, Nietzsche and the Postmodern Condition. Some postmodern theorists have written in collections called After the End of the World. They write essays, what do we do now that the world's over? Now that there aren't any humans left, you know, what do we do in our word processors now? Sort of a new question, theoretical. Well, to find out why people write weird things like that, it's good to go to Nietzsche and trace this the development of these values and of moralities from the Greeks through the Christian religion and on to this situation of nihilism that Nietzsche will discuss. Well, one of the ways that I like to do this is to try to warn you right away that if you read the Genealogy of Morals, and I hope you do, all of you, it's a good book. You should read it. It's fun. You'll have to read it. There are lots of good books if you do read it. Watch out for a sort of invidious binary in the text, masters and slaves, master morality and slave morality. The reason you should watch out for this invidious binary is that for Nietzsche, these are metaphors that tell you something about the origins of these value systems, and ultimately you will find out that for Nietzsche, neither are satisfying. In other words, they're not positions he would adopt now. They're part of how our culture's moved. He will identify the Greek ideals with master moralities and the Christian ideals with slave moralities. Hardly surprising, now, is it? Because even if you see a Chuck Heston movie about early Christianity, you notice what you could hardly help but notice, that the origins of Christianity are among the classes of the despised, the oppressed, and the slaves. Hard to miss. Jesus isn't hanging out at the Kiwanis Club. He hangs around with hookers and cheats and frauds, charlatans, all the time. Only time he ever bumps into religious people, he just pisses them off, kicks over their tables, makes fun of them in their synagogues. Well, I mean, that's a fair reading of the New Testament. That's not outrageous. Just read the damn book. Again, through long canonical use, you can lose the ability to read. Nietzsche said one bad thing about Christianity is it can make you forget how to read. It'd be great to read the New Testament and pretend you'd never heard anything about Jesus. It'd be a lot of fun. Because you might find a totally unrecognizable character. You know? I mean, he had one real close woman friend. She's a hooker. I mean, that's not interesting to you. It is to me. Wasn't the wife of the vice president, the current vice president. It was a prostitute. And I'm not here to stone her because I did agree with perhaps one of his profound remarks, Jesus is the New Testament. That's with that, if you're without sin, you can cast the first stone. And that generally would stop a lot of stonings, I think. This is not a sermon, but it's just a piece of advice. Well, Nietzsche in Genealogy of Morals contrasts the master morality of Greece with the slave morality of Christianity and then follows it through to its next phase. One of the reasons he could do this so brilliantly, I think, is because of his background as a philologist. Nietzsche's background as a philologist warned him that certain words that were important in evaluation underwent very interesting semantic shifts between the Greek period and the Christian period. So, for example, the Greek word for excellence, arete, which is as close as we can come to saying it in West Texas, arete, might be another one, the Greek word for excellence comes to be translated in the Christian medieval period as something different, and then by the time we get to the King James Bible, and this is important, I want to just skip sort of to the King James Version, because now we get for excellence something like, trying to think of the exact word here, the movement is from excellence to virtue, yeah, piety. Sometimes as narrow as piety, virtue, piety. Well, let me try to give you a sense for the difference, and then that Nietzsche wants to draw out here. An excellent Greek, on the model of the master set of values that the Greeks held, was someone like Odysseus, a great example from Quito, a nice example of an excellent Greek. He was excellent because he was, in a sense that today we wouldn't understand at all because of the division of labor, he was well-rounded. Odysseus could tell a lie well, which is a virtue. To know when to lie and to who and about what is a virtue to the Greeks. It's a powerfully smart one. For example, if a god questions you about if you messed around with something, it's very nice to be able to fool him. Odysseus could build a boat, drive a furrow straight, sing a song, you know, fight in a battle, throw a discus, many other things. There's a lot to him. Very well-rounded, interesting. Noble values. In short, these noble values were what Nietzsche calls active powers that, as it were, would see what they wanted to act upon and then act upon it. And those were, for him, noble values. And he calls them master morality. However, they are naive. He points that out later, and I'll get around to that when I try to explain. Now I want to make the quick move from that idea, that Greek ideal of excellence, which is well-roundedness in many areas. Well, if you think of that and then you think of something like virtue, don't you see that the semantic terrain has almost reversed? Because certainly in the Victorian period, to be virtuous meant to deny one after another all those aspects of your active powers which were celebrated in this earlier use of the word. Namely, I won't do that, it's a sin, I'm virtuous. I won't do that, it's a sin, I'm virtuous. I won't do that, it's a sin, I'm virtuous. I won't overeat. Sex, out of the question. No. Just say no. Just say no. So Nietzsche's point was that this transformation from a master to slave morality was life-denying, not life-affirming. Life-denying. And it was life-denying in this first, quite ordinary sense. Namely, that the active powers that human beings wanted to realize become inwardized, turned against themselves, and become a series of just say no's to various aspects of the things that make us human. Things that are ignored by theorists, academics, philosophers, literary critics, and others. Topics we ought to discuss. Like, how good's our food? How warm's our house? How much fun do we have having sex? We don't talk about that much, and yet that's the fabric that makes a life that flourishes. Not whether Shakespeare's in the canon or not, or whether Mel Gibson plays him or not, but whether we're healthy and well and feel good and, like Odysseus, can do many things and enjoy a whole bunch of them. That was, at least, this is the movement that Nietzsche wants to trace. Now, these life-denying values of Christianity, he's not simple-minded on this, and his criticism of Christianity is not simple-minded. So I want to end this lecture on the genealogy and then pick the genealogy up in the next lecture again with the following remark. Nietzsche didn't think that the movement to what he sees as the slave morality of Christianity and its life-denying aspects is entirely negative because it made the human race more subtle, more devious, more mendacious. Oddly enough, until Christianity came along, human beings, according to Nietzsche, weren't nearly tricky enough, weren't nearly clever enough, mendacious enough, creative enough. No, the Greeks who, you know, just, well, I lied to a god, I did this, and it's... No, Christianity goes, I love you, in this very strange way we'll examine later. but not until it comes into the world, as Nietzsche sees it, do human beings actually become these sort of subtle, mendacious, tricky people with deep subjective problems, strange consciences, and guilt with all its many wonders is born into the world. And we'll discuss that next time when we return to the genealogy of morals.